Back with you on Connecticut Today, Thursday, March 18th, 2021. We were joined by a Quinnipiac University professor to give you a few warnings and a few tips on how to handle all those COVID stimulus payments and why you may want to wait just a little bit in filing your taxes this year, especially now that the IRS deadline is May 17th. We gave you portions of Governor Lamont's latest COVID briefing on the eve of Connecticut relaxing some of its COVID limitations. And I also gave you my thoughts on the ongoing controversy and the messaging and now the political football that's evolved from those tragic shootings and deaths in Atlanta.
This tragedy at these Atlanta-based, well, you know, massage therapy, massage places, whatever. You had this guy go in and shoot up a bunch of these places, 8 people dead, 6 of them of Asian descent. I mean, it's a horrible, it is a horrible thing. Any loss of life like this is deplorable. And like I said, you know, and I mention it only because I know there are people thinking, well, you've never experienced this. No, I have had a very dear relative in my extended family shot and killed years and years and years ago. In fact, it was 43 years ago. So I know how that is. And I know what terror that can bring to the family. But what is driving me nuts about this case is this apparent insistence that we immediately, I mean, there can be no wait here. You can't wait to get the facts of the case. And there is this immediate insistence from the White House on down, apparently, and it's only gotten worse since yesterday. There is this immediate insistence from the White House on down to make this part of an anti-Asian wave of crime. Which obviously goes back to President Trump, and obviously goes back to, you know, white flannel shirt wearing gun toting Americans here. I tell you, all over the place. Now, the police chief in Atlanta who talked about this, he was asked by reporters, and I've been to these police news conferences, and some police prefer to say nothing, and some police prefer to say stuff. You know, some police say, listen, I'm going to give nothing to the press. I'm sorry. The investigation is still ongoing. I've been instructed by the DA, the prosecutor, not to say anything. Okay, fine. Other times they say something. Now, this police chief in Atlanta, let's call it for what it is. He didn't do himself any you know, favors yesterday. He didn't. Two things not working in his favor. With the phrase he used, because, well, we have the guy, we have this suspect in custody, and the cop said something like, or the chief said something like, he had a really bad day. Well, geez, chief, that's not, I don't think that you want to say that. That sounds a little flip. Okay, strike one. They also found out in probing this chief's social media post that he had reposted some place that was selling COVID-19 T-shirts or sweaters with some sort of a mock beer logo talking about the China virus. Okay, that's strike two. I get it. So all this having been said, and you've got everybody out there, the mayor of Atlanta is going nuts, the White House is making innuendos, and look, this may very well have been a hate crime. I'm not going to say it wasn't. This may very well be determined to be a case of domestic terrorism. Yeah, sure looks like it, right? But no matter what this chief may have said, no matter what he may have done on social media, those are separate issues. And earlier today on my Facebook page, and those of you who are my friends, it's not a public page, I don't need the great unwashed reading. My personal page, if you want to friend me, you can send me a friend request. I'll check you over and I'll think about it. What I wrote earlier today was this, and I'd like your thoughts on this, at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I simply said, quote, I have a novel idea. How about we wait until local police, the FBI, and other investigators are finished with what they have to do, before we determine whether or not the Atlanta killings were racially motivated. I know that might slow the Twitter mobs just a bit, but I think it's worth it. That's all I said. That's all I said. And I have got people I know responding to me. Oh, my God, look at this. He pushed this sort of T-shirt. Look at the phrase he used yesterday. Yeah, I'm not denying any of that. I'm not denying any of that. But this is a symptom of a bigger problem we have. And I talk about this all the time, on and off the air. This is a symptom of us not having any patience anymore. And having to take what is the narrative of the day. And I'm sorry if I put it that way. But there's an immediate knee-jerk reaction to spin this as a white guy killing Asian Americans, which six of the eight were. I get that. No, well, they're Asian American, but they were Asian descent. That's fine. I get that. I understand what the facts of the case are. But that's not the whole story. And because we live in the age we do, where everything is instantaneous, the weather anytime you want it, the sports, the news, live play-by-play on your phone, live radio here, WICC on your Amazon Echo device, whatever you want. We don't wait anymore. We don't have the capacity to do this. We don't take a breath anymore. We don't relax anymore. We don't give society a breather. Perfect illustration was the Meghan Markle interview. Oh, look at that. They asked about the color of the baby's skin, and now people are going, well, that wasn't really a serious question. It was said in kind of passing. Well, they took my passport. Well, none of the royals carry their passport, right? Well, we had a secret ceremony, and this vicar in the Church of England go, no, you didn't. We can't find any evidence of that. But because it's said, and because it's out there, boom, it's got to be the truth. So with this whole thing, with these Atlanta killings, which are awful, I just wish to God people would just calm down and wait until we hear what the police, the FBI, the prosecutor, the district attorneys say, and whether or not what happened fits into the accepted definition of what is a hate crime or terrorism. It may not. Wait. Let the investigators do their jobs. And if it's one way, it's fine. If it's another way, it's fine. Other things people don't understand about this case. And we'll come back and talk about those as well. You know, another thought I have, or more, a few more thoughts I have on these Atlanta killings over the past week, which, again, have been horrible. I mean, six of the eight people killed were of Asian descent. You know, there are people who would say, and this is my point, of we have to be very careful while being able to talk about how horrible things are and how egregious some crimes are. We have to be, I'm sorry, I have to say this, we have to be very careful that for the good of society, we don't overreact to this. And you saw the mayor of Atlanta yesterday sniping with her police chief for what he said. You've got people in Congress sniping at each other. And I'm telling you, we have really lost the ability to take it easy and wait for the facts to come out. And then once you get the final facts, or the facts as best they can be determined by professional investigators, not people in their armchairs with their phones or people at their desks with their desktop or with their tablets spotting about what the world should be. We're talking about professional investigators, psychiatric professionals, interrogation professionals, people who look back at this guy's, you know, this gunman's background. What do they see in his social media posts? Obviously, they interview people who knew him. They're going to interview his family members. They're going to look back at his gun records. So they will take their time doing this. But because we're in this situation now where we seem to have a searchlight out and antennae up all the time for this blanket hatred that we can just use like some intellectual money here or intellectual capital to just spout everything under the sun is nuts. It's crazy. And why am I saying this? Oh, Paul, you're just blowing off steam. Well, I'm doing it because it raises tensions. Was this guy actually anti-Asian? Who knows? You know, a lot of people, for example, and hear me out on this before you go nuts, because those of you who know about some of these places, and I've found folks with me that agree with me on social media here, pointing out certain spots in Connecticut and in Fairfield County where this is. You know, the common person might hear this, right? The common person in somewhere's USA, right? They may hear the story and go, look at this. Six of the eight people that he killed, they were Asian. He was obviously targeting Asians. Well, he's telling the cops that he felt uncontrolled because he was a sex addict. He had been treated before, and something inside of him snapped. And again, he's mentally ill. Okay, let's put that at the forefront here. Yes, it may have targeted at Asians, but the guy's mentally ill. What have I been saying for the past 2 or 3 days? Mental illness. Mental illness to the point where this guy, apparently what he is saying, and even what some of his friends and family members are saying, he snapped. He snapped. So a lot of these so-called spas, and listen, I don't have to tell you this, folks, all right, because we hear about them in the Connecticut area, right? We read, you know, you listen to radio like WICC, you read the local newspapers, the Post, the Register, the Current, you watch television. A lot of these places, as somebody pointed out to me today, we're discussing this on social media, who's also in the news business. Unfortunately, sometimes these spas are fronts for things that they are really not. You know what I mean? And sometimes there are certain gangs, groups, ethnicities. It spans different crimes for different ethnicities. We know this. And they are operated by people who are trying to deal in illicit things. So the six people that unfortunately of Asian descent that were gunned down, does that mean what this guy did was necessarily anti-Asian? Would he have walked, for example, into another business if he had some other predilection or some other mental incapacity and gunned down, geez, I don't know, six Italians or six people who were Hispanic, although I guess one of the other victims who survived was a Hispanic gentleman. Again, my point is this. We need to simply, for the good of society now, because this is getting a little crazy. This is getting a little nuts. It really is. These are horrific crimes. I get it. But there are prosecutors and district attorneys and local police and the FBI and forensic pathologists and psychiatric professionals for a reason. Let them do their jobs before it becomes the latest politicized football. Oh, look, I'm going to show how concerned I am. Well, that may make you feel good, but in the end, it doesn't do any good. Wait, is there a pattern here? Maybe this was domestic terrorism. Maybe this was, a biased crime. The professionals will tell us. You don't find it out in 24 hours or 48 hours. You don't. And it doesn't do, it doesn't do public servants from the president on down to start talking about it when we don't know the reason yet. We need to be patient. And this is a pervasive factor now in society that is really causing us to go off the deep end here. Okay? Calm down. Stay away from your keyboard. Take a breath and say, you know what? I'm going to let the professionals handle it. And if you don't think the professionals are doing the job, well, then there's other layers of professionals all the way on up to the federal government to do that. The Fed's announcing earlier this week that tax day is not April 15th. It is now May 17th, not May 15th, because that's on a weekend, May 17th. What does this mean? Is this a big deal or is it just another month and 2 days? Here to help us wade through that is the director of the Tax Clinic at the Quinnipiac University School of Law, Professor Sarah Spodek joins us. Professor, hi, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Wonderful to speak with you on this rainy afternoon.
Yeah, it's a good thing we're dry, though, all dry and warm here. Were you surprised the government, the IR, the IRS folks stretch this out, or did that not come as a surprise that we're getting a month and a couple of extra days here?
It did not come as a surprise. This has been an incredibly tumultuous time for the Internal Revenue Service, as well as for taxpayers. There's been a number of provisions that were just recently passed that will help taxpayers and that actually require the Internal Revenue Service to sort of reprogram its computers during filing season. One of the most important provisions is that taxpayers who received unemployment compensation in 2020 can exclude from their income the first $10,200. So that's a really big benefit, and that is something that the Internal Revenue Service needs a little bit of time to fix in their computer system.
So if they got unemployment compensation because of COVID-19, Professor, in the last year, in the 2020 tax year, the first $10,000 of that, you said, is now tax-free, not subject to an income tax. What about for folks, though, who may have filed early? Is that a problem? Or did a lot of folks do that?
So here's the thing. We don't have a definitive answer now with the correct way to approach this issue. The Internal Revenue Service may be able to do automatic math correction on these and issue refunds retroactively. At this point in time, if a taxpayer has received unemployment income or, say, has a rebate recovery credit, meaning they didn't get their economic impact payment early and they're claiming it on their 2020 return, that we ask and we are recommending our clients in the tax clinic to hold off on filing their 2020 returns, maybe for, say, about a month. Let's wait for the IRS to reprogram the system and get that in there so we don't end up in a situation with amended returns. And I just don't have a clear answer on that. This has been one of these, the past, I would say, year, like for many other professionals in other areas, has been a very opaque year. We've really struggled with trying to find the right answers, and things have been moving very quickly for us.
I like opaque. I think opaque is a good word when it comes to taxes. I think that fits. Hang on, Professor. Professor Sarah Spodek is the guest. She directs the tax clinic at the Quinnipiac University School of Law in Hamden. More on taxes straight ahead. Professor, right back to you. First, traffic and weather together. 3:36 on WICC. And usually, at one time or another, we're talking taxes, especially this year, coming off of COVID-19. Just seeing some of the light at the end of the tunnel here, what to do with your taxes. And Professor Sarah Spodek is on the line. A few more minutes with her. She directs the tax clinic at Quinnipiac University School of Law. So, Professor, we touched on folks maybe holding off because the IRS has to kind of reprogram their computers to allow that first $10,000 of whatever unemployment folks may have gotten last year. What about the stimulus payments? Now, I've heard both that money is taxable and it is not taxable, going all the way, for example, back to the first payment under President Trump. Can you straighten me out on that?
Yes. None of the payments, those economic impact payments, are taxable.
Okay.
So not the first one that was issued in the early round of relief, not the second one, the $600 one, nor will this third $1,400 per citizen be taxable.
Now, do you know, Professor, if, let's say you have people who have a balance due with the IRS, and I do that some years. I tend to adjust my withholding depending upon, well, I could use a little extra money. I'll take it now, then pay the IRS back on an installment. Or no, I want them to take as much money out as possible. I've made a game of that over the years. But if a person owes money to the IRS, would that, do you know, affect them getting a stimulus payment if they fall within those income ranges?
All right. This is actually a very interesting and timely topic. So economic impact payments, as they were written under the 2020 passage laws, were exempt. The advance payments were exempt from being taken for a federal tax debt, but they could, or any other federal tax debt, but they could be taken for child support if you had outstanding child support. Okay. Now, these amounts, if you didn't get them for whatever reason, right, and the way to claim it, or you didn't get the full amount that you were entitled to, need to then be claimed as a rebate recovery credit on your 2020 return. The way the law was written, those amounts then are not exempt from a federal tax debt, so that it then becomes a credit, so to speak, in your tax return. I know we're really getting into the weeds of the mechanics of how a return works. I do understand that.
No, that's fine. I've used the same accountant for 20 years, so I've been through this. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So now what has happened is that there's been a fair amount of rumblings from either, Congress for different members of the tax community that really mm-hmm. advocate for individuals. And we have really pushed forward and hoped that the Internal Revenue Service could program its computers to specifically target the rebate recovery credit and yeah. have it be refundable. It looks like we've been successful. Mm. We don't know what will happen with individuals that have already filed the return. We're hoping they can identify that and refund it. We don't know for sure. But moving forward, again, another reason to just hold off just a little bit more as this comes out in the news and plays out, that rebate recovery credit then should be able to be refunded to individuals.
How many pages? I know you probably don't know this, but just, how many pages is the tax code? Is it like a few thousand or something? I mean, I hear this stuff
really
every year.
It's really enormous. It is. And I can tell you that since last March, the sheer number of changes and things that have happened have really been mind-boggling. But what we have to remember is that we are asking the Internal Revenue Service essentially to deliver pandemic benefits, right? Yeah. Because it's one of the only institutions we have that every American touches.
And
so we're asking a lot of an institution that already exists. And one of the things that is also hard to, sort of grasp is that the Internal Revenue Service has been underfunded for a number of years. And so we're asking more of an institution that has been asked to perform with less.
And we're still asking them too. I mean, they do perform, besides processing returns and refunds and setting up payment plans and all this, they do perform sort of, maybe not in the strict sense, but sort of a law enforcement function as well, raising red flags on people who are not just working the system in their favor, but might be actually breaking law, too.
That's correct. There's something that your listeners should be on the lookout for, and that's a new letter going out for individuals where the Internal Revenue Service program system is concerned that this person has had some sort of identity theft. And I just today received news that one of my clients who filed what's called a rebate recovery credit only tax return, they basically put $1 on the return and filed that in order to obtain the rebate recovery credit because they didn't get it through the economic impact payments, those advanced payments. Okay. This individual's return was flagged as potential fraud, and a letter goes out from the IRS with like a code number that this individual now will have to call the IRS and verify their identity. So they, and sadly, right, the drawback is that this individual now needs to wait longer for their money that was always intended to be an advance payment. But the benefit of that is we know that it isn't getting into the hands of a wrong person.
And, Professor, obviously, I know you want to emphasize this because we have people from tax-related fields on all the time, anti-fraud people. The IRS will never call you, correct? I've been told that numerous times. They do.
The IRS
do it the old-fashioned way. Yeah, they send you letters, right?
They send you letters, and the Internal Revenue Service letters are very clearly letters to you, meaning it will not always have your whole Social Security number. Oftentimes it does, but it will, say, have, four of your Social Security, your last four, and it'll have a lot of identifying information.
Yeah.
There are letters out there that are scam letters in some way, shape, or form. Sometimes it's direct marketing for tax resolution firms where they try to make themselves look very authentic as a letter from the IRS in order to drum up business. But be aware, look for the IRS logo, look for indicators that it's real. And if in doubt, you can always reach out to a tax professional to verify it.
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, attorneys and accountants cost money, but they cost money, Professor, because they're professionals and they know this. And anybody beyond a simple 1040, I always tell them, get an accountant, get somebody who knows the laws, because as you say, and I've got four or five accountants in my family, I see them, at holidays. I say, hey, how's it going? They just go, oh, I've been reading for 3 weeks.
That's
amazing.
It's a very accurate statement. And it's in this season, particularly, if you have doubt, reach out for a professional for help. There's also, for individuals with limited means, the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance programs.
Mm-hmm.
They exist. They will provide free representation. These are trained individuals. It's not an arm of the IRS. These are individuals that are volunteering their time. Oftentimes, you'll find accountants, law students, accounting students, various different people who really want to perform a civic duty and volunteer their time to prepare people's taxes in an appropriate way. So that is one place that people can get help.
Yeah, finally, Professor, I want to ask you, what is your opinion, if you want to just tell me, what is your opinion regarding, some of these programs we see advertised? For example, TurboTax is the big one. It's been around for years. Hey, we'll walk you through this. We get you more deductions than Brand X or if you do it yourself. What are your thoughts on that as a professional doing this?
I think that when you hear we get you more, it's really just a catchphrase. Everybody is entitled to their fair share or their certain amount. And if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. So the programs that you hear, those tax preparation services, are really programmed to trigger the appropriate numbers that you should be getting. Don't look for more extra deductions and squeak it by. Don't open yourself up to an audit. And if something feels fishy, say in an in-person return preparation service, maybe it is. Just take a step back. If the numbers seem too good, they may be.
Professor Sarah V. Spodek is the director of the Tax Clinic at the Quinnipiac University School of Law. Professor, thank you. We really appreciate this. Thanks, and we'll talk in the future. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Professor Sarah V. Spodek. She directs the Tax Clinic at the Quinnipiac University School of Law. So what did she say? Get an accountant. Seriously, especially now with all this stimulus stuff and whether you got money the first time, you didn't get money the second time, what can you claim, what can't you claim? You have an extra month. So she said you can wait till the IRS clears its nostrils here, its computer systems. May 17th. It's not April 15th now. It's May 17th.
A reopened committee going back almost a year ago, he and Indra Nooyi. So love to hear his perspective on where we are sometime later. First, let me give you a quick run through of where we are. I think the daily summary continues to show relative stability. And I think for us, that's a good thing. Positivity rate, 2.7, 2.8%. We've been between 2.2 and 2.9 for over a month, and that stability gives us some confidence. Hospitalizations, the key metric, still good capacity there. Fatalities, 15. I often look to Europe as a bit of a crystal ball to see what's going on, and I was talking to Albert about this earlier. It seems to be sort of a tale of two cities, where you have parts of Europe like Rome and Paris are closing down again for another month or so, given the spread of the infection. Other cities like London and Tel Aviv are opening up. Obviously, London knows something about the UK variant. That's where it probably kicked off. But they were able to manage because they were getting their people vaccinated. And Israel is able to manage because they're getting their people vaccinated. In other parts of Europe, there's still some vaccine hesitancy, much lower levels of vaccination. So that just reminds us, as you look what's going on in the bifurcated Europe, how important it is that we continue to maintain our vaccination efforts. And I'll tell you why we remember. There was a really good piece by Ken Dixon signaling it was exactly 1 year ago that we had our first Connecticut fatality 1 year ago. And 1 year later, we've had 7,821 of our Connecticut neighbors have passed away. So it's a remembrance of what a year it's been and how we're coming out of it by staying together. And speaking about getting out of this, on a more positive note, here's the vaccine update. And, you know, we're moving in on 2/3 of our people, the most vulnerable, 55 and above, have had their first dose. Overwhelming majority of the folks, 75 and above, you know, up just a tick or two since last time. 65 to 74, 3/4 of them have been vaccinated. And we've gone from, I guess, 40 to 46% of the folks 55 to 64. And it's worth noting, you know, Josh was checking again this morning. There were appointments open, often on the pharmacy sites. So for those 55 to 64, here's your last chance perhaps to book an appointment because, as you know, tomorrow we're opening up to the next age group, which is, you know, the 45-year-olds and above. Today, we've had about 33%, 1/3 of all of our adults have received their first dose. And that's an important note. And next time we talk, we'll have over 1 million of our folks have received their first dose. This next chart I thought was pretty interesting. It shows you how long it took and what the pickup was on the different age groups. If we had about a month for the 75 and above, so that's because we had many fewer vaccines then. And, you know, we're close to 80% of them have been vaccinated now. 65 to 74-year-olds, that was about 350,000 people. That took a little over 3 weeks. The next age group, 55 to 64, that was about 500,000, and that took a little less than 3 weeks. So what's going on is as we get these younger age groups, we're able to do it faster. We're getting a lot more vaccines. And also it does appear that there may be a slightly lower take rate as well. You know, 45 to 54-year-olds, that's 475,000. That's a lot of people. But, you know, about 1/4 of them have already been vaccinated because we've prioritized our healthcare workers, our educators. They fall into that category. So for the next 2 weeks, 45 to 54, and I think you can see that there's a ramp up and then it tails off a little bit. And, you know, frankly, the other reason there's a blend here as we move from age group to age group, because in some of our communities, 2/3 of the people, 55 to 64, have been vaccinated. In others, maybe it's just 1/3 of our some of our cities. And we want to make sure there's no vaccine left on the shelf. And that's why we've moved into the next age category tomorrow. The other thing we're doing tomorrow is expanding our capacity. We can talk about that a little bit. Our restaurants, I was at the main pub today in Manchester. They've been doing it well. All the plexiglass, maintaining the social distancing, wearing of the mask, and 8-person table capacity, 11 p.m. curfew, but 100% capacity. Rather than go to 75 or 85%, which is what some other states are doing, very difficult to enforce. And the main pub and our other great restaurants have earned the right to get up to 100% capacity. Same as we're doing with libraries, museums, aquariums, gyms, fitness centers, continue to wear the mask in those gyms and fitness centers, a lot of breathing. Retail offices, personal services, nail, hair, and houses of worship. So tomorrow is a big day. And I want you to make sure that while we're opening, keep your caution, pop your head in, make sure that restaurant is maintaining the protocol, so you feel comfortable going back indoors. Movie theaters and performing arts, keeping them at 50% capacity for a little bit longer. Just because they tend to be a bigger crowd in movie theaters, maybe you're eating and sitting in close proximity to somebody for maybe 2 hours at a time. Other things when it comes to reopening tomorrow, just as a reminder, we've been through this before with David Lehman, indoor private parties, 25 people up from 10. Still be careful. Obviously, if you're with people who have been vaccinated, you know them pretty well, you can relax a little bit more. If they're people you don't know as well, continue to be careful. 100 outdoors for those private events. Obviously, outdoors much safer. Commercial venues, maybe you've got a caterer there at a commercial venue. 100 indoors, 200 outdoors. 11 p.m. curfew. Sports are going again now, and the travel advisory starting tomorrow is now an advisory. It's not a mandate. But still, if you've been vaccinated, you have a lot of flexibility when you fly back and forth. If you've been down there in Miami Beach and you've had a party and you have not been vaccinated, I want you to test and I want you to quarantine when you come back. I've seen what some of those parties are, and they could be super spreader events. So please be careful. Just one other thing before I introduced Albert is the PPE. You remember where we were a year ago? Remember all that talk about the stockpile in Washington? There was no stockpile in Washington. You know, thankfully, our hospitals and some of our nursing homes had a bit of a stockpile. You know, Josh and his team scoured the globe, and you can see that we purchased about 327 million pieces of PPE, mainly masks, gowns, gloves. We used, about a third of it. We have 200 million pieces right now to make sure we're never caught short, make sure that we're way ahead of the curve going forward. And that just gives you an idea of one of our new master facilities. You're not going to count on Washington for the stockpile. We're going to count on ourselves. And finally, an introduction to Dr. Coe. Couple of things just to think a little bit about the vaccine immunity. He can talk a little bit about some of the testing they're doing in Yale, New Haven, what that's meant in terms of the immunity. Seems to carry over for at least a year. That's very good news. And just a reminder that the vaccine works. We've had a year of experience with it. We've had hundreds of millions of vaccinations have done. And we know from the nursing home experience that it's brought down fatalities and hospitalizations to close to zero. What a difference that makes. Albert, welcome back. It's good to see you again.
Thank you very much, Governor, for the opportunity to come back and to join you in this press conference. So I'd like to make three points and to highlight some of the comments that you had made earlier in your presentation. I think the first one is really starting out with the good news, and that was that the CDC report that was done as a collaboration between the Department of Public Health and Yale University that showed that a single dose of the vaccine actually provided significant protection on the order of 60% to nursing home residents. And we know from other studies done in Israel and in Europe, as well as the United States, that initial dose, does provide a level of infection that's important in keeping our communities safe. And it highlights success stories on several fronts. First is this is the collaboration between the Department of Public Health and Yale throughout this pandemic. This particular study was led by Vivian Leung from DPH and my colleague, Sunil Parikh. And it also justified the rapid rollout and the prioritization of nursing homes that really protected our nursing home residents during that initial surge. And it also underscores kind of the hard work that the Department of Public Health had done before even those vaccines were rolled out in with respect to mass vaccine testing, control, COVID recovery units that were set up throughout this state, which actually ensured that we didn't repeat what happened in the first surge when we had our second surge in November, December, and January. The second comment is it's put place a cautionary note that we're not clear of COVID at the present. And I'm actually concerned about what will happen or may happen in the next weeks or months. We know that these variants of concern, the UK variant, the South African variant, and now the Brazilian variant have been detected in the state. And these variants are more transmissible. And at least from what we know at this moment, the UK variant, which we call B117, is actually more virulent and is actually can cause higher risk of mortality and hospitalizations. And we've seen, as the governor has said, that it's caused this third wave in Europe and required lockdown Paris just announced today that we will undergo lockdown for 1 month. And we really can't repeat the mistakes that we've experienced in the United States and other states have gone in reopening too quickly and prematurely, and such as in Florida, Texas, among others, and also relaxing the face mask restrictions, which we know, you know, are important in preventing transmission. So cautious, you know, approach to reopening, as the Connecticut is doing, with continued use of face masks, avoiding the large gatherings, which actually drive super spreading and transmission, is going to be key. So let me end up on the last point, which is the good news, which is that although we are in this race against time with these new variants and the potential public health threat that they pose, we're making really important progress on vaccination. I would not have expected, and this has far exceeded my expectations, that 80% of the population over 75 would be vaccinated at this point. And it seems like we're on track for all the other age groups that are following to reach that goal of 80%. 80% is important because that's when we're going to start seeing population level benefits of vaccination. And, you know, that's, I think, really to the credit of this age-based rollout, which makes complete sense in with respect to protecting those most vulnerable to the severe effects of COVID, whether it's hospitalizations and deaths, and getting the vaccine out as quick as possible. Any mass public health campaign needs to be implemented as simply as possible and as quickly as possible. And we can't forget also in parallel that those large impacts of the pandemic that has been experienced by our underserved communities. So in parallel to these broad horizontal campaigns, which is getting the vaccine to as many people as quickly, we have to, and as the state is planning, as DPH is carefully implementing with local health departments, with the healthcare systems, is to increase vaccine access and promote vaccination in our underserved communities, those communities with highest vulnerability, social vulnerability. So with that, let me stop, and thank you again, Governor, for inviting me back for this press conference.
Albert's sticking around. Josh and Paul, any questions?
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, I guess my first question will be for Dr. Ko, you know, based off of what you just said. How concerned should we be with the New York variant? And do you see it threatening our reopening, not necessarily for tomorrow, but maybe in the weeks to come?
Yeah, so I am concerned about the New York variants. There are two sets of variants. Those are variants where we have good evidence, scientific evidence, that they're more transmissible and that they, in some cases, are more virulent. And those are the UK variant, the South African variant, the Brazilian variant. There are two more that made the list. And those are variants from California that are present in our state, but they haven't taken off like the UK variant, which is replacing all other strains very quickly. The New York variant, we're still learning about those. They have spread, so we suspect that they may be transmissible. We're really waiting for good epidemiological evidence that in fact is the case. What's particularly concerning about the UK variant is they harbor certain mutations that may enable escape from the immune response, either the immune response elicited by having a COVID infection in the first place, in increasing the risk of reinfection, or potentially our vaccines. And I think one tenet that we have to really follow by is that a virus can't needs to replicate in order to mutate. And the best way to prevent that replication and mutation and to prevent these vaccine escape mutants from occurring is to decrease transmission and to control transmission.
Got it. And so, you know, Governor, based off of what Dr. Ko said, you know, when it comes to our daily positivity rate, is there a percentage that you're going to be looking at going forward in these next few weeks?
A little less involved in the positivity percentage, a lot more concerned about hospitalizations. That would give us a better idea of whether this highly infectious strain that is a possibility in New York that you and Albert were just talking about, whether that's impacting our hospitalizations and our capacity. So I think that's going to be number one Right now, our hospitalizations continue to stay low because the most vulnerable in our population are getting vaccinated fast.
And should we have reason to believe it is in our state right now?
Oh, absolutely. Not like it is in Texas or Florida or some other places, but there is clear evidence that, you know, in particular, the UK variant is here and spreading, and that the vaccine works against it.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. Just following up with Dr. Ko, what you were talking about, you know, the various concerns that you have right now with the virus. So with that as the background, is tomorrow the right day to lift these capacity limits in the state?
Okay, so as the governor said, our hospitalization rates, they've kind of plateaued. They've gone down and they've plateaued out. We've also had decreases in the number of our cases. And so, I think the answer to this is what's happening in terms of getting vaccinations. It is a race against time and getting vaccinations ramped up. Let me make two caveats of what I said before. The first one is that we know we're certainly concerned about what we think are vaccine escape mutants. We still need more evidence to understand whether certain variants actually can escape the vaccine. We know that, for example, the South African variant, there may be lower, protection confirmed by vaccines against, in preventing mild disease. But actually, this is the case with the J&J vaccine, which was just recently licensed, it was actually quite effective in preventing deaths and hospitalizations. In the end of the game, the key issue here is going to be preventing really the severe morbidity and the mortality caused by COVID. So getting the vaccine out to those people who are most at risk at death, the elderly, those with underlying medical conditions, is going to be key in this race against time against these variants.
Thank you. And to the governor, I know we're just about 8 hours or so away from eligibility reopening or opening to another age group. I know you in the past have really stressed patience to those people who are looking to sign up, but can you help set some expectations for people either logging on tonight at midnight or early in the morning tomorrow about, are there going to be appointments available and how far out might they be finding them?
They may be finding them out, 2 or 3 weeks. That's true. And Matt, as you know, at the beginning of every new age cohort, as they come on, there tends to be a rush. That's why I always urge patients, and I particularly urge patients of those who perhaps don't have the same level of risk as other people. Let those that can't telecommute, those who are forward facing, those that maybe have some sort of a condition they think maybe puts them more at risk, yourself certifying, but give them a little bit of space. We're going to have plenty of vaccines for everybody in this age cohort over the course of the next couple of weeks, and we're going to have plenty of vaccines for everybody starting in less than a month.
Okay, thank you.